good morning to all. We're just about to start the class. We're just running a few minutes late. We'll start momentarily. Okay, good morning. Just running 1 minute, 2 minutes late. I'll be right with everybody, okay?
Okay.
Left off last week, we just a little bit more left in that Ibn Ezra, and we'll do that now. Okay, Dave, any questions or comments before we start?
I'd like to say good morning. I missed a couple of classes here recently.
Hey, how you doing, the judge?
Back on.
How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good, how are you?
Okay, thank God. I heard you all settled into Arizona?
Yeah, we're getting settled. Yeah.
All right, so I'll
be here anyway.
I'll be there for a week. I'll see you next week. I'll be there for a week.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Good. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, same here. Okay. Okay, so what we were last doing was Ibn Ezra was explaining a number of verses and how to show you how to understand them, because taking them just on face value, you know, and just looking at them in a vacuum would present numerous contradictions, as you know, we've shown. Okay. Let's just see what we're up to. We talked about how he said that there's one verse in Kohelet which says that it's good that a person should eat and drink, but that seems to be a problem because it's talked about earlier that a person engages in those drives, so then that will remove him from wisdom. So there he says, when he says that it's good that a person should eat and drink, who is the person that he's addressing? So he says this is a response to the fool that works and gathers all his money, but he does not enjoy any of it. So what good is that? That's a foolish lifestyle. A person is supposed to have, I mean, God gave us taste buds, he gave us senses, and the person is supposed to have an equilibrium that's created by, you know, a moderate, you know, approach where he balances his life between the pleasures and they're used in a manner to target the primary goal of a life of wisdom. But a person can't be involved in wisdom if he's not eating it, if he doesn't feel good, if he doesn't at certain times he enjoys a steak, right? So these pleasures are something which God made available to us. The fool is the one who restricts himself, to the wrong extreme. So that's the person that he's speaking to when he says that it's good that a person should eat and drink. But not, he's not telling you that a person should just be involved in life of eating and drinking. Okay, so it's important that we see clearly what Ibn Ezra is explaining. Then he says, another verse where it talks about it's good that a person should go to the house of mourning better than going to a house of a party. So this, Ibn Ezra says, this is an absolute truth. Remember, we talked about conditional truths or situational truths. Then there's absolute truth, something which is always good for everybody. But a conditional truth would be in terms of eating and drinking. That depends who you are. If you're too much engaged in it, then you should restrict it. If you're not enjoying it at all, then you should engage in it. Okay? It should be clear. And then he talks about what benefit is there to the wise person. So that seems to be a real problem, because wisdom is, it should be an absolute good. But he says, this is a person who goes after wisdom like a fool. So if he's not satisfying his soul with it, meaning he's not really engaged in it in terms of the pursuit of wisdom per se, but maybe he uses it as a tool, or he uses it to get self-aggrandizement, like people that learn in order to put down others. If that's their objective, so then the learning is no good in that case. So you have to realize that when these verses that King Solomon has written, as Ibn Ezra teaches, they cannot be looked at in a vacuum. You have to understand what is the actual application. What's the case that he's talking about? And then he says another case, King Solomon says, and there is great benefit to wisdom. When he says that quote, that's an absolute. Because there he's talking about wisdom itself. He's not talking about the person. Right? The other place he says, if you're exact with the wording of King Solomon, which we must be, when he put down wisdom in the previous sentence, he says, what benefit is there to the wise man? Meaning the wise man who utilizes wisdom for his own selfish goals. So there he's talking about the wise man. But then when he says that there is benefit to wisdom, that's divorced from a person who would manipulate it and abuse wisdom. There he's talking about the just wisdom per se. So that's why he says that there is greatness to wisdom. So that's always the truth. All right, so you see, when you read the verse, you have to be careful as to what is he saying. I mean, I was looking at Maimonides, he has this great work, the Mishnah Torah. So I've been captivated lately by the area where he talks about the temple and the vessels, because his formulation of the laws is so precise and gives so many hints as to what's going on. And one place he talks about he switches very subtly from talking about the exact location of the altar, and then he says that for example, he's talking about that the location where King Solomon and King David had built the altar and the temple where they sacrificed the animals, that was the same location where Isaac had been almost sacrificed on by Abraham. That was the same location as where Noah built the altar when he left the ark, and where Cain and Abel offered their sacrifices, and also where Adam offered a sacrifice when he was created, and that was the same location where Adam was created from. But the point is that he switches off in one case between saying that the location was duplicated throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia actually, and then he says that the altar was, he switches between the, let me see exactly how he says it. He says in one place that the location is exact, where numerous generations had sacrificed. But then he says the altar was exact, which means to say that the altar that was built originally by Adam was also the same altar that was used by Noah, which is an amazing insight. We can go into it perhaps at a separate point, but what I just want to bring out is that if you read it quickly, so then you just think he's talking about the same location, which is more easy to understand. I mean, it's a great idea in and of itself, but it's easy to understand that the location was the same location where everybody sacrificed. But to say that it was the exact same altar for thousands of years, or hundreds of years, the exact same altar of stone, earth, whatever it was made out of, it survived so much time. It survived the flood, and when Noah came out of the ark, he was sacrificing on the same altar that Adam and Cain and Abel sacrificed on. So there you see Rambam's putting in a new point just by having a specific word. He's not saying it's the same location that Noah sacrificed on, but it was the same altar. So a person is sensitive to the text, so he'll be amazed by that. And then we have to look into that. Why should that be? What was the necessity of the altar surviving? But if we just... Yes.
So I have a question about the methodology there.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're concluding that, well, in this verse, Solomon meant this as an absolute, but then in this next verse, he was talking about something else. But then when we get over to the next verse, he's talking about an absolute. And it almost, I mean, if I were coming at this skeptically, I would say, well, you can interpret anything that way if I can take the sentences, tear them apart after the fact, and conclude, well, this one he really meant, but this one he sort of meant, this one he meant allegorically, this one he meant literally, you know, kind of like politicians after they say a particular thing, they come back later and the press secretary says, well, what he really meant was da-da-da. So what's the defense against the argument that another religious group might make, saying, well, you guys are just reinterpreting everything to make it fit something because it doesn't make sense on its face. Do you see my question?
Yes. I mean, well, first of all, we don't trust a taxi driver to teach us about quantum mechanics or astrophysics or whatever. We need somebody who's trained in the area. So if people want to come along and throw their interpretations without having the science of those, you know, those interpretive skills, that's really meaningless. We don't care. In terms of the real point is when and where and how does it make sense? How can we be convinced that we have the correct understanding? It seems to be, it's like you're saying, it's like a free-for-all. Where's the rhyme and reason to when you take something as being an absolute truth and when it's conditional, right? So that we have to look at the context. If we see that wisdom is something which, you know, the Torah is the primary command, that's what the whole essence of Torah is. And then we see King Solomon, who was the wisest man next to Moses, and he says that, you know, what benefit is there to the wise man? So that has to throw up a yellow flag if wisdom is something which is praised. So then we understand that can't be taken just on face value, because of course living as a wise man is great. So it must mean something else. So we know that there is a reality that this whole book has to use as a backdrop. Now, once we have that reality, these verses have to be measured against reality, just like anything. Like Maimonides says, we accept only three things as truths in life. Number one, that which we experience, meaning events. We experience something, we know it happened, we know it's true, it transpired. Number two, we accept as true that which our mind tells us. 2 + 2 = 4. Our mind tells us that, then that's it. That's another way to know absolutely what a truth is. And three, that which is transmitted through the Torah from the rabbis. So now that we have that, and we have the promises and the prophecies that the Torah is never going to be lost, so now we've got an even stronger argument against, you know, somebody who's going to come in and say, well, you know, your book is no different than our book. So, again, everything has to be tested against reason, but we have prophecy as well, and we know that's a reality. So we have those two elements that are, you know, we use as barometers for truth. So, and also what we have is specifically in the verses, again, we have to look and see, does this, number one, does it measure against reality? Well, how, again, I can't say that a wise man, how could that be non-beneficial to be a wise man. Isn't that what the Torah is all about? And if King Solomon says, what benefit is there to the wise man, then I must stop and think. He must mean something else. Because I already know a truth, that wisdom is the greatest. When I see also that he changes between wise man and wisdom per se, now I can see that this great intellect, King Solomon, that he's changing the word for reason. And that's why Ibn Ezra picked up on it. And says, when we talk about wisdom per se, that's something which is always a good, because that's not something which man has yet tampered with. And he can't change wisdom. Wisdom is something which precedes man. So far, so good, Doug?
I'm with you, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay. And then we have to see how it works, you know, how we apply this method in all areas. Like, for example, when we see contradictory statements. Eating and drinking is no good. Eating and drinking is good. So we have to make sense out of it. But again, King Solomon does this. He catches the ear of the reader. And he's using this method in order to attract the person. The contradictions is something which forces a person to think. If everything just sounds very nice, it's not going to attract the person. Then his critical faculty will be disengaged and he won't be trying to analyze. But when you see two statements from the same person, and he proved at the beginning of this commentary that the statements of this whole book are not multiple authors. So we know it's one very brilliant intellect that was miraculously gifted with wisdom at a very young age. So we know for sure then that these verses have to all be in consonance with each other. Okay. And as we go through it, it'll resolve the questions.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So are you getting your interpretation from the commentaries, how you know what a conditional definition and what's an absolute definition?
Yes, that's coming directly from Ibn Ezra's words. He says that when it says that what benefit is there to like a wise man, because that's applying, he says, to when the wise man, I'm reading straight from what he says. He says, the verse, the matter, for what benefit is there to the wise man? So that's the end of a quote. And then Ibn Ezra continues, and he says, this is applying where? That if he performs his wisdom like the acts of a fool, that he does not satisfy his soul, so what benefit is there to him? That's the case where a wise man is not going to be involved in anything good. When he's using the wise man, when he's using the wisdom, just as a tool for his own endeavors. But then he says after that, but there is another quote, he says, there is benefit to wisdom. And I think the end of that verse is like, there is benefit to light over darkness. So that, Ibn Ezra says the following, this is the truth. All right, that's without qualification. That means that's an absolute. So I'm getting it straight from his words. But also, if you look at it, you can ask a question, well, how did Ibn Ezra know this? If you look at the words, is what I'm bringing out to you. That one verse is talking about the wise man. There you could have a wise man that is worthy of a criticism if he's abusing wisdom. But the other verse says just wisdom itself. So that has to always be good. That's not talking about a person who abuses wisdom. There it's talking about wisdom per se. So we could see where Ibn Ezra is getting his ideas from right from the verses. Is that clear? Okay. Okay, we good so far, everybody?
Yes. Yes, thank you, Rabbi. Very good.
Okay, Francesca, is that clear?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. He goes on, and he says, and also I praised happiness, simcha, just to be happy. Okay, let me see how it goes here. 1 second.
Rabbi?
Yeah, 1 second.
Okay.
1 second. Have you stood, if you put on your mutes, please, get just some feedback from, let's see, the other questions, all right. Just 1 second, there's one verse here which has got me. He says an interesting verse. He says, well, not a verse, a commentary. He continues the commentary. And he says, and I praised also happiness for those who weary themselves, they toil in this world, and they don't seek out wisdom that makes them happy. They are still better and praiseworthy than those who just worry about mourning. So when he talks about Simcha, he says that in one case I praised Simcha, right? So Simcha just means the person's like happy. He's just it's laughter or being lighthearted. So, because in another case, after he says that he criticizes Simcha, what does it do? He says, into Simcha, into happiness, what does it do? So now it sounds like in one case he's praising happiness, in another case he's rejecting it. But again, if you look at the verse, you'll get the answer. So in one case, if you're comparing it to people that are just living mournful lives and worrying about death, that's a wasted life. So at least the person who has a good, lighthearted nature, that is more praiseworthy than the person who's morbid. Doesn't mean that's the goal in life, all right? That's not the goal in life, of course, but it says that the person who is right. So in that case, it's better off than being the morbid state. But then he says, that's just criticizing the happiness or lightheartedness itself. But then he says, and that's where he praises it. But in another case, he says, what does happiness do? And then Ibn Ezra says, this is the truth. Now he presents us with, you know, a problem. Because now he's making an absolute statement. But how can you say that's an absolute statement if in one line before in his commentary, he's saying that he is praising happiness. So if you look at the words, you'll see. Because in one case, where he's praising it, he's talking about the state of happiness. That, there is a certain benefit. If you're comparing it to a person who's morbid and thinking about death, so the person who's happy is at least better off, his state of mind is better. But when he talks about if there's an objective, what does it do? What does happiness do? That, he says, it does nothing. So in terms of what there is accomplished, then it doesn't do anything. At the moment, it gives a person a release, but there is no long-range benefits. So therefore, there's no more contradiction. Okay, does everybody see that?
Rabbi, I'm sorry, I'm lost. Which verse are you on?
I'm still in the commentary. There's no footnotes here. I can't take exactly the verse. But he makes two quotes. Ibn Ezra makes two quotes. He says, one case, I praise Simcha, I praise happiness, and another quote says, what does happiness do? So how could King Solomon say, on the one hand, I praise happiness, on the other hand, he criticizes happiness? So the resolution is that when he praises it, it's in contrast to a person who's morbid. You'd be better off being happy, happy-go-lucky. But when he criticizes it, he's saying, but in terms of what does this happiness do, that, he says, it doesn't do anything. It is better than being morbid, but if we talk about what it does for a person, there's no long-range effects. That it doesn't benefit the person. It doesn't give him any perfection. So again, he's just going through various apparent contradictions to show you how to understand the, you know, King Solomon's words.
Is he covering a particular section, or is he just covering the whole general philosophy?
Yeah, he's picking, Ibn Ezra's picking different verses from the entire book of Qoheles that seem to be in direct contradiction to each other, and he's resolving them.
Oh, okay. I mean, I'm trying to go back to where the text is that he's quoting from, and I can't find it.
Yeah, he's not. I don't have it here either. But he's quoting verses in Qoheles. That, you know, it's a big work, so it's hard to locate them. Rivka, you had a question?
Yeah, Rabbi, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Doug. Please excuse me. I'm just trying to understand why there's two concepts here. A person could be, his predisposition could be to be being morbid, which is not such a great thing, and he's not such a happy person. And he has to look at things to be grateful because we're put here to be happy, and we should be the simcha, we should be happy. But there are also reasons. The second thing is there's also reasons where a person would not be happy, and there's actual occurrences, events that happen that cause a person to be not so happy. So there's
that's not what you're discussing.
I'm not too clear, but in my way of thinking, it's that King Solomon is trying to explain to us that basically we should be the simcha, we should be happy. What is event? It's another thing, but we should.
No, that's not. That's not.
Is that what it is?
You're missing the point. Also, please turn off your speaker on your computer because you're getting feedback. Turn off the speaker on your computer. But that's not what he's talking about. That's not what he's talking about here. He is simply saying that there are numerous verses that are contradictory, and he's resolving them. He's not going into that, you know, a person's outlook and so on. This specific point, again, we have to be clear and just focus on what the point is at the moment. And his point at the moment is that if you compare a person who's happy to a person who's morbid, the person who is morbid is worse off. So there, he's praising happiness. But if we look at what happiness does, so then he says, no, it doesn't do anything. All right?
Okay, great. Thanks.
That's the idea. Okay. All right, then he goes on and he says, another quote, and I praised the dead. What do you mean he praises the dead? I mean, they're better off. So Ibn Ezra says, this is in contrast to those people who are living lives of oppression, and they just have, there's no benefit whatsoever in their existence. So in that comparison, the person who's dead is better off. Right, he talked about that. Better off is the stillborn. We talked about that. All right? And then he says, another verse says, it is better to be a living dog, right, then a dead lion. So then, because there, where is that statement coming from? He says, this is a statement of men. And this we've said numerous times, that when King Solomon says something, it sounds like he's praising something which is ridiculous. We said that it's not him saying it. He's quoting the opinions of people in order to catch the ear and wake them up, and they'll feel, hey, yeah, that's how I feel. And then he tears it apart, and he shows that idea is false. So like this case, where people have the opinion it's better to be a live dog than a dead lion. So that is the opinion of people that are foolish, that feel that life itself is an inherent value. Okay? That's why a person would say, even though I'm not a lion, I'm just a dog, I'm the lowest of the beasts, but hey, I got life. Meaning to say that they feel that there's nothing after life. So that's false. And there he says that's the opinion of people. Eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. People feel that when they die, that's the end. So that's where this statement comes from. I'd rather be, you know, I hear people, I mean, I hear people in my circles, you know, they talk, and one guy is talking to a very old man, and And he says, "How you doing?" The old man says, "I'm still here." See, even the old man, that's, you know, he could be in the Jewish community and be raised observant, but if he does not think into his life and try to learn and apply it to himself, even in his old age, he's lost one of the most important lessons. And he feels, "I'm still here." Meaning to say, as long as I'm alive, I've got it better. But that's not true. God has a plan for us after we pass. Okay.
That's a very important point, Beth. I thank you for mentioning that. That is true.
Okay.
People think like that. And it's we have to put them back on track, because it's not over when they think it's over. It's just beginning.
Okay, let's go further. And he says, another place is written above, that the heart of man is full of evil, and foolishness is in the heart. And so this is true, because there is no thought in their words, meaning what they do. She says, that's true. And then in chapter 3, where he talks about that there's a time to every attitude or desire. So Ibn Ezra says, this is also true. There is a time for everything. Don't think that was something which King Solomon was trying to show you, that don't think that there's anything absolute. People are looking for that in life. They have an insecurity, and they're looking for certain attitudes or feelings or things that they can occupy the time with, that is a safe activity that will always, you know, yield happiness and success. But King Solomon says, no, that's not true. Sometimes you have to change gears. Sometimes it's time for mourning. Sometimes it's time for war. Sometimes it's time for peace. You have to analyze the situation and use wisdom. And again, still getting feedback. If you have a mute button, please turn it on. Thank you. Okay. Let's see. Okay. This is right. So the matter of that is a time for everything. So he says, that's the truth. Who MS? Opinion. And he says also another verse. And here's an interesting one. He says, there's another matter that King Solomon writes. There will not be good life to the wicked man, and he won't have long days. It'll be like a shadow. So this, he says, this is the majority of cases. Why? Because sometimes you see a wicked person is living long and has a great life. But in general, that can't be. That's not God's justice. In specific cases, even if we can't answer it, but when he gives a rule, so a person may think that's an absolute all the time. No, you have to understand. Again, sometimes things, he's making a statement that is the majority. And why does he say this? He makes his interpretation evidently because we do find, you know, a few cases where the wicked could, you know, escape justice. But the majority of cases is not that, okay, not that way. Okay, so again, we're testing it. Again, back to your point, Doug. It's an interpretation that has to comply with reality. So therefore, we can't say in all cases he means that every single case a wicked man is going to have a short life. Because some cases we see that he has a long life. So therefore, it must be that he's talking about majority. Okay, so that's how it makes sense out of his words and the reality that we perceive occurring on earth. Okay? Then he says another matter. He says, and there's another sentence which says in Qohelet, he says, Yesh Rasha, there are wicked, that they're found at certain times, but few times. He says, because on account of a little bit of evil, right, so the God's wisdom may not decree that because the person is evil, that he's going to be diminished from from a lot of happiness. I mean, it could be a person is wicked. I mean, he's continuing his point. Because it's only in a few cases that you'll see the wicked will have successful and happy lives. Why? Because of the evil that they did, it may not be God's wisdom above to hold them back from happiness. We don't know God's calculations. Okay. And then he says, we're coming to the end over here. He says, V.H. Mephaz of Anosif Ode. There are some that scatter. He's talking about money here. And they're given even more money. So he says, this is, again, a minority case. And he says also, there's another verse which says there are certain wicked people that the life that they enjoy is like the life of the righteous. I mean, they have great lives. And we find in this work of Gehelis, one second. He says something and repeats it, and then he says the opposite. So also we find this in the work of Proverbs. He says in there, he says in that work, he says, don't answer the fool. And another verse in Proverbs says, answer the fool. So you see that King Solomon again, in his other work of Proverbs, he uses contradictory statements. And we even find this in the words of the prophets and the God's Torah, which is the essence. In one case, we see there will not be the poor man. And then we see another case in the Torah where it says the poor man will not cease. And then he concludes and says, but it's all one thing. And that's the end. That's the end of his long commentary here in 7:3. Okay, so he shows you that not only does King Solomon use contradictory words here, he uses it in Proverbs, and the prophets also speak that way, and even in the Torah we find apparent conflicts in statements. So again, we have to use intelligence in all cases in order to derive the truths. And again, the method that will be used is to we use the guidance of somebody brilliant like Ibn Ezra, who shows us that there's many ways to resolve the problems. But it's all going to be following one rule, and that is that it complies with reality. Sometimes he's saying something that's addressing, not an absolute, it's conditional. In this case, it's better to be happy than to be morbid. If you're comparing it to a person who's morbid, another case he criticizes, and he says, what does happiness do? But you see, he makes a change. He's not pitting up happiness to happiness, then that would be a direct contradiction. He's saying happiness in one case, and he says, now what about the accomplishment of happiness? Is there an accomplishment element? No, there isn't. If, however, he would say there is never a good to happiness, and another verse says there is a good to happiness, that would seem to be an apparent contradiction. All right? Like he says, by wisdom, to the wise man, so what good is it? What benefit is it? Yeah, because certain cases a wise man will use wisdom for his own purposes, his own selfish goals, and not for the wisdom per se. But when it comes to wisdom itself, not the wise man, but the wisdom, that's always a good. That's an absolute. All right, so again, it's a good thing maybe to review this, and you'll see what the you can derive from it, the more principles. But as we go on, I mean, as we continue in this book, in this great work, so then perhaps we'll be able to apply what Ibn Ezra is saying. Okay, let me see if you have any questions or comments. And one question on screen, Chaim is asking, King Solomon shows both sides of the coin, but what is his conclusion of the correct direction? Right, so that we need the commentaries to show us. So King Solomon is giving us a very cryptic type of a work, because that's how his goal is to make a person think and to derive what the truths are. So that's what Ibn Ezra did for us today. He showed us the truths that on the surface, it seems like he's saying the wise man, what good is there? How can King Solomon say that? And 2 seconds later, he says that wisdom is always good. He just says that what benefit is there to the wise man? So we see that he's talking about a person who can abuse wisdom. There's no benefit. But then wisdom itself, that's a whole different discussion. We resolve the conflicts. There's no contradiction anymore. So we use Ibn Ezra's explanation and Rashi and so on to arrive at what the truths are. So really, King Solomon is not only showing us two sides of one coin that seem to be in conflict, but if we look into his words, we can see where Ibn Ezra and the other commentators are deriving the answers from because of these subtle nuances. All right? Like, well, wise man versus wisdom. Or happiness versus the purpose of happiness. Those are two different things. I can say that happiness in one case is good, and I can say that the purpose of happiness, now I'm not talking about happiness itself, but I'm talking about, is there anything gained from it? That's not talking about happiness anymore. That's talking about, is there anything that results from it? So in one case, we're talking about the attitude. In another case, we're talking about the results of the attitude. So there you can say one is good and one is not good. Okay, let me see if there's any questions or comments.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I can understand how a person can abuse wisdom, but somebody who abuses wisdom, are they really wise?
Someone who abuses wisdom really what?
If somebody's studying wisdom and they're abusing it, I can understand that, but are they really a wise person?
Yeah, a person could have a certain amount of wisdom, and I mean, I've seen it. I've seen somebody, I think I mentioned a case once where a guy was a big teacher at a big Jewish university. And so he's got a lot of knowledge under his belt, but he only used it for the sake of ego. So he knew a lot, but it was worthless. A person could be very analytic. He could develop analytical skills, and he could really derive truths. But if he's doing it all for the sake of promoting his own agenda, so he may be wise, but he's not perfect. So you could have wisdom in a person, but he could be lacking perfection too. You see, we talked about that last week, that a person will use his ego. His goal of the ego, he'll harness his wisdom to plan out a very good campaign to win an election. But there, the wisdom is only being used as a means to his ego. But he won't really have the highest wisdom, interestingly. I mean, to your point, Francesca, according to Ibn Ezra, that type of person doesn't have the highest level of wisdom. It seems to be a person really has the highest level of wisdom, he's enamored. He's really taken back by it. And it should affect him. It should affect him that he's his whole goal to have self-aggrandizement is lost because he's amazed with God now. But I guess we'd still have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. Doug, hey, how you doing? All right, are we on target with resolving your question in terms of the original question about, you know, other people that would come in and make statements and make their own interpretations?
Yeah, I think I understand your approach.
Yeah. I mean, you have the, what was that famous case where it's chapter 55 or 53 in Isaiah where the Christians use it to say that he was abused and he suffered for our sins. And they want to use that as a case to say, oh, you see, it's talking about Jesus. Right? So they'll come in and take some verses, and but they'll completely misconstrue them. You see that even the Jews will do that. You have certain Jews that will take a verse from the book of Job, where Job was telling his friends in his own defense. He didn't understand why he's been afflicted. You know, head to toe with leprosy, and lost his family and his wealth and his home and everything. And his friends are all trying to give him answers why this is happening, and he rejects all the answers properly, and he shows his friends, his three friends, that they're wrong. And at one point, he even says that if I would stare lustfully too long at the woman, not stare lustfully, but if I would stare too long at a woman when I'm trying to pick a wife for my son, so if I looked at her a little bit too long, So that would, what portion would I have with God above? Meaning I would lose my portion if I would engage that type of a lifestyle. And even there, he's looking for a couple of extra moments. You know, it sounds like it's a harmless thing, but he was very careful. So people today will take that and they'll say, when Job said, you know, what portion will I have with God above? They leave out the word what, and they take the words portion of God above, and they say, oh, there's a proof that there's a portion of God above in every single person. There's a piece of God in every single person. So you see a person can distort things. And Rabbi Che talked about it once. He said that you could have the most clear statement that God is one, the Shema. And it says, listen, O Israel, God is our God, God is one. So the statement says clearly that God is one. And the Christians will take that and you see, oh, you see, it says God's name three times in this verse. There's a proof for the Trinity. So if a person wants to be corrupt in his thinking, you know, he can do it even with the most clear statement. What we have to do is see clearly what the context is and understand what the rabbis are teaching. And it has to make, you know, it has to make sense. Nothing should be forced. Shouldn't be a forced explanation. It should be perfect with the verses. And I think Ibn Ezra showed us that you can see the nuances and how he resolved the conflicts. It has to be done intelligently. Okay. All right, so I think we'll wrap it up here. And we'll continue. We're going to be starting next week. So we got through, we did three. All right, so we'll pick up from 7-3 in the verses and go further. All right, we already did 1 and 2. Right. All right, so pick up from 3 and a little further. Okay, somebody had a question?
Yeah, just that you're still going to have class next week. It's Memorial Day weekend, but that doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't. I'm just asking.
Right. Good point. Unless I'll let you know otherwise. But for as far as now, yeah, we'll still class.
Okay.
Okay. So wish everybody a good week, and we'll pick up next Sunday.
All right. Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Okay, my pleasure, everybody.
Thanks, Rabbi. Good week, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.